Let's talk. John Brown. Operation Pimiento, my great-grandfather's great escapes, is a thrilling and moving account of one man's extraordinary escape from the Nazis as told to his great-grandson. It's written by Adam Hart, and I'm delighted to say that I'm joined live on the line by Adam himself. Adam, good morning to you.
Morning. Thanks so much for having me.
No problem at all. Whereabouts are you, by the way, this morning? Where do we find you?
London, you find me this morning.
Jolly good. Right, so this is a story of... Well, it's one of those incredible... I always say this to my people I interview. You know, it may be 80 years since the end of the war, but we are still uncovering and discovering quite amazing stories of heroism, not only by those who served, but by ordinary people. And I think this book is an absolutely underlines that fact. Tell me a little bit about, first of all, your great-grandfather.
Sure, yeah, that's probably a good place to start before going on to those civilians. But yeah, so my great-grandfather, he was called Frank Griffiths. He was a North Walian. He was quite a maverick individual, hell of a character, never really cared for the rules or following what anybody else did, which is funny that he actually ended up in the RAF, given that that was his way of going about things in life. But anyway, he did end up in the RAF. He started out in the Far East, came back home in 1940, and he was a test pilot for about 3 years. And then he joined an operational squadron and was basically supplying the resistance in Europe with arms and war material and dropping agents, you know, spies and stuff into France, all this exciting stuff and terrifying. And it was on one of those missions that he was actually shot down in France. And had this absolutely remarkable escape. Well, firstly, that he escaped with his life. And secondly, then he escaped across Europe back to the UK.
Because he's flying, it's a Halifax, isn't it? It's one of those, it's a heavy bomber. It's not like a Lysander, which was, you know, the small aircraft that used to sort of pop in and pop out again. So they're flying, presumably they're flying low level. What part of France was he aiming for, as the saying goes?
Yes, exactly. That's some great historical knowledge already there. The main two aircraft they flew were, Lysanders and Halifaxes. But he was Halifaxes, so they were flying, very low, dropping containers full of Sten guns and money and propaganda leaflets and, you know, anything that would help the resistance. What was the second part of your question?
Whereabouts were they when they came down, and how did they come down? Were they shot down? Did they hit something? Did they hit like a telegraph pole? I mean, did you find out what brought the aircraft down?
Yeah, I mean, so it is still even today not known for sure, and it depends on who you ask. The story I've written up, the version I think is most likely, and I think the version that Frank died believing, was that he was brought down by small arms fire, which would match with how low they were flying at the time. And it would also match with the fact that because they couldn't find their reception party, this was just outside Annecy in southeast France.
Right.
In the Savoie region near the Alps. And they couldn't find their reception party, so they were flying up and down Lake Annecy, basically looking for them. Really, really low, 3 a.m. in the middle of the night, waking everybody up. You know, it's a Halifax four-engine heavy bomber. And Frank found out after the war that Italian soldiers, the Italians occupied this bit of France, they basically were just taking pot shots at the aircraft with their, you know, rifles, with their normal firearms. And basically what happened is one of the bullets severed a fuel pipe in the port wing and just starved those two engines of fuel. And you're in a massive Halifax four-engine heavy bomber in the bottom of an alpine valley, which won't, and the aircraft won't climb, and you've got mountains on either side, and it's the middle of the night. So you're not in a great situation. And he crashed. He crashed into a village, which is now basically a part of Annecy, but back then it was just a village outside of Annecy. And terrible, terrible crash. All six of his crew, so seven on board, six of his crew were all killed instantly. And they were all I mean, they're all lads. They're all 20 to 25.
Yeah, I mean, having read through some of the bits and pieces. I mean, it is. It always gets you how young they are. Is he the pilot then? Is he the flight officer? He's not. So he's the pilot. And how old is he at this point? Because I mean, there's 20-year-old, 22-year-old. One of them was only two missions from ending his tour, wasn't he? That was really sad.
Really sad. Yeah, Frank was ancient. Frank was 30, so he was very old. Yeah, he was the pilot. Yeah, and he thinks that he survived. Or well, he also believes that he survived. Again, it's very hard to know for sure, but he thinks that he survived because he, obviously, being in the cockpit when the aircraft touched down on the first house, he was basically catapulted through his cockpit, still actually attached to his seat, and he went straight out the cockpit. On impact, knocked out of the cockpit of his aircraft into the night sky. And rather than hitting a building or the floor and presumably being killed instantly, he somehow managed to hit telephone wires that actually broke his fall and entangled him. And the next thing he remembered was regaining consciousness in telephone wires. So which, you know, presumably saved his life. Six crew all in the aircraft, in the tailed, considered the safest place, all killed. And then also on the ground, five civilians also killed in this terrible fire that then ensued with the Halifax fuel and the war material they were carrying catching fire. So it's a terrible, terrible tragedy, really. And that was the first miracle that he survived.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's a fluke that brings the aircraft down, as you said before, severing a fuel line. And with something that big and that heavy, you're not going to get out of the situation. But also a fluke that he is caught up in, entangled in these telephone wires, or these wires. I mean, it is that, you know, so there's two flukes, if you like, there. You say, obviously, the people know there's a Halifax buzzing around before it gets brought down. Then they really know there's a Halifax around, because obviously there's a huge fire and there's been a loss of life, you know, civilians as well. Presumably, I mean, he's found by villagers who must be in absolute shock, because they were just sitting having their, you know, having a quiet evening or in bed or something, and the next thing, sort of hellfires come down on them. And they've got the presence of mind to rescue him. And I know it's that perhaps he's a little more fortunate that they're in sort of Vichy France rather than they're in the sort of north, you know, along the Atlantic Wall, because that would have been obviously a different kettle of fish if the Wehrmacht or the you know, or the Nazis got hold of him.
Absolutely, yeah. So I mean, that's another good point. This is Italian occupied Vichy France, so. I mean, you don't want to be shot down in Europe, but you definitely don't want to be shot down in German-occupied France at the time. This is, I mean, a slight, I know Italians have only got probably a month or even a couple of weeks before they go out of the war, so a lot of their forces had sort of thought the writing was on the wall and weren't particularly interested in the war anymore. But yeah, and then this is where, you know, he staggers away from this horrific, horrific crash with his life. And this is where the remarkable escape begins. So the next 3.5 months, he's going to spend living secretly, being helped by these incredible, ordinary people in France. But the very first one is, so he's broken shoulder, broken wrist, cut face, presumably whiplash, concussion, you know, really badly cut and bruised. And he's staggering away. He's throwing up as well. And the first person he meets in France is a 14-year-old boy who has cycled straight to the crash site. Bear in mind, this is 3 a.m. and he sees Frank wearing his sort of flying gear, whatever it is. And he says to it, and Frank says to him, "Where are the Bosch?" And this boy goes, "They're all Italians around here." And Frank says, "I'm going to walk to Spain." And the boy says, "Don't do that. Come with me. I'll take you to safety. I'll take you to my mother's house."
Here's the thing. First question, does your great-grandfather speak French, or is he just lucked out and got like a 14-year-old sort of multilingual schoolboy?
So he speaks schoolboy French.
Right. Your great-grandfather, not the schoolboy, because the schoolboy obviously speaks French as a schoolboy, but yeah.
The great-grandfather, yes, schoolboy French. So he probably would have been half French, half English, sort of just getting by.
Yeah.
In my book, I've just written it in English. So obviously so that people can read it. But yeah, and literally, I mean, he's semi-conscious, and this 14-year-old boy takes him and puts him on his bike and realizes he can't really stand up. So he folds him over the handlebars.
No.
then just pushes the bike, and he gets his other mate. This other 14-year-old then arrives, who's one of his mates, and they push him up this hill together. And Frank remembered, he told family members who were lucky enough to meet him afterwards, that there was a nut in the middle of the handlebars. And he said he didn't have the strength, because he was only semi-conscious, to support himself. And he remembers this handlebar nut just boring a hole into his sternum, which was absolute agony, but he couldn't do anything about it. But that obviously stuck in his mind. And anyway, these lads took him to safety, hid him, and this boy's mum started giving him first aid. And this family, the Fontaine family, they're called, and they roused the local resistance. And that's how he got taken into the resistance in the area and hidden from the Italians.
Yeah, because obviously they're going to be looking for him, aren't they? And they're going to say, has anybody seen? Having seen a picture of the crash site, the village, I mean, it's pretty horrendous. This isn't like, so they were probably in sort of shock anyway. And again, it's Vichy, it's the Italians. So, and I don't mean to designate them, but it's 1943. They're about, things aren't going well. You know, Mussolini's pushed for a second Roman Empire. He's had to put the white horse on hold. He was going to ride back into Tripoli with, but it's like, how did they actually, this thought just struck me, did you manage to find out the route they took to get to where they crashed? Because I'm thinking, they're in Southeast. They took off from a base, presumably on the sort of Southeast coast of the UK. Have they gone straight across and down? Because that's an awful lot of low flying, and that means going over Nazi Germany, and they've still got the Luftwaffe going. And, you know, as the American Air Force or the American Army Air Force are about to find out, spoiler alert, if you're watching Masters of the Air, you know, flying during daylight, the Luftwaffe are still pretty, have still got a hell of a reputation. So how did they actually get to the final destination, as it were?
Yeah, so I have seen a map of it. I'm not particularly good on my French geography, but they had the big advantage of, if you're watching Masters of the Air or know a little bit about bombing missions in the Second World War, they'd fly in huge formations of hundreds of aircraft. Whereas the squadron that Frank was flying for was one of these two special duty squadrons, they were called.
Right.
Which was the dropping spies and supplies, like I was saying earlier, to the resistance. They had the benefit of they would always be flying alone.
Yeah.
Just the one aircraft, often really low and often always at night as well. Yeah. So usually a bit safer. They were obviously safer. They were obviously still vulnerable to Luftwaffe night fighters, to, you know, bad weather. Basically the main thing that got them killed was poor navigation.
Yeah.
So they tried to pick routes that were as least as safe as possible, so they knew, you know, tended to know where flak batteries and that kind of stuff was, anti-aircraft things. So basically they came down across the channel. I think they actually crossed the Normandy coast somewhere.
Wow.
And then straight down over the center of France, and then sort of turned east.
Yeah.
And I think there's a mountain range there somewhere in that sort of bit of France, and basically slipped over that in the moonlight. And then came down into the sort of Lyon area.
It is quite amazing, isn't it? If you think about the navigation, because we think of flying without, because an awful lot of crew are lost to mechanical problems as well. You know, it's these aircraft aren't built for safety, as it were. They're built for military operations and navigation at night, low level. I mean, it's quite amazing. And the reason they fly, because the RAF always fly at night, because they know the damage. And that's when the American Army Air Force come and they go, well, we're going to fly in things of 10, and there's going to be a wall of, you know, bullets. And it's like, okay, well, you chaps carry on, but we've tried this before. So anyway, let's get off there, because otherwise I'm going to go in a completely different rabbit hole, Adam, and I did warn you about this. So the resistance are contacted, because obviously then something's going to come down, and then we have this route. Now, where he is, because we all know about people going over the Pyrenees, and I literally, if I stood at my desk and looked out the window, A, this would be a very strange interview, but B, I could see Gibraltar. And that is where people are trying to get to, you see. So we know of people coming over the Pyrenees. There's an awfully long, way to go between where he is and shall we say, the safety of getting into neutral Spain.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Initially, because he'd crashed in Annecy, that's very close to Geneva, very close to Switzerland. So the initial goal was just get to Switzerland, neutral Switzerland, get in there and you're under your own steam, recover from your really terrible injuries, and, you know, getting contact with the UK and see what's what. So that was what they set about initially doing. So his first, after he'd been with this Fontaine family, this 14-year-old boy and his mum, who gave him some first aid and stripped his English clothes and burnt them and given him some French ones and stuff like that, he was then taken to this first safe house in the resistance, which was a sort of restaurant slash brothel. It's like a perfect allo sketch. And anyway, he was taken upstairs, and there's a wonderful part of his oral history that he left at the Imperial War Museum where he goes something like, oh, I was taken to this restaurant and I was taken up to an upstairs room, and God, it was awful. There was lace curtains and it smelt of perfume and it looked like a Portuguese brothel, is what he says.
It's a wonder. You said he was a bit of a maverick. He wanted to decide to see out the entire rest of the wall there, to be honest with you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But anyway, he spends 3 days there. Remarkably, Italian soldiers even come into that restaurant to get drunk.
Yeah.
And he's literally lying upstairs and he can hear them. It's absolutely incredible. But as you said, the war is nearly over for Italy, so they're not really that interested. Anyway, he's then moved to a new safe house. He spends 3 days there near the Swiss border. And then after 6 days in France, the plan is hatched for him to go over the border into Switzerland. And that involves a local 22-year-old woman called Colette, who's this like pretty blonde girl, who's actually the mayor of Annecy's daughter. So she's actually got money as well, which is unusual to be on the Allies' side. And the plan is that she's going to pretend, Frank and her are going to pretend to be lovers, and they're going to walk.
What a terrible cover story he must have lived for your, you know, this is sounding rather wonderful, to be honest with you.
They're going to walk the last few miles to the Swiss border, hand in hand, just pretending to be sort of strolling and chatting in love. The thinking being that the Italian soldiers guarding the border would see them and think, oh, it's just two young lovers out for a stroll in the hay. You know, this is August. We'll just, you know, leave them be. That, no, that won't arouse any.
They're Italians, of course. I mean, what they, you know, this is absolutely, it was Germans different, but I think, yeah, ciao, bella. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. And then it works. So they stroll their way to the border. Frank had a funny memory of it. He said it was ghastly strolling along hand in hand, worse than crossing the Dutch coast at naught feet on a moonlit night, is what he said.
Presumably he was saying that with his tongue firmly in his cheek when he was saying that, surely. Or he means the actual, well, am I going to get caught, am I going to get rumbled sort of thing, rather than sitting with a very pretty, and Colette is a name straight out of Central Casting, isn't it? If you were doing the Hollywood movie, Adam, you would have a beautiful French girl called Colette, you know. I mean, that would be so he gets into Switzerland. Does he, I mean, I was going on, I was rambling on about Spain. Does he get to Spain at all? Right.
So he gets into Switzerland. They manage to contact MI9 in London, which is the sort of escaping, not society, you know, escaping part, which helping downed airmen escape. And they come up with this crazy plan to repatriate him by flying a Sunderland flying boat to Lake Geneva in the middle of the night, and him being rowed out to the French section of Lake Geneva and being taken home. Crazy plan, absolutely crazy, doesn't come off. They've only got 100 or so Sunderlands anyway, and they're all desperately in need of being used in the Atlantic. So anyway, that doesn't happen. So he goes across the border, new plan, and goes across the border back into France, and he meets up with this incredible, incredible woman. She's called Françoise Dessard. She's a 62-year-old French woman.
Yeah.
Chain-smoking... recluse, incredibly eccentric, terrible health. Basically,
this is wonderful. I'm loving this. Madame Dessard, you know, played by Edith Piaf, basically. But yeah, go on.
Basically survives on black coffee and cigarettes, nothing else.
Welcome to my world.
Yeah, just this incredible, incredible character, you know, so passionately French, hates the Germans. And anyway, she was a courier in one of these escape networks. There are various escape networks across Europe taking British and American airmen who've been shot down south to Gibraltar, as you said, yeah, to get back to the UK. Anyway, she's leading one of those escape lines. And anyway, she meets up with Frank and she transports him on a train from basically from Switzerland, from Geneva, just over the border, down to Toulouse. Overnight train,
yeah,
super sketchy. I mean, at one point, you know, it's all, you know, Frank's basically pretending to be mute and he's trying to follow her lead and let her do all the talking and deal with the ticket.
They can't
control.
Do the old lover's trick again, can they? Let's face it.
No, they can. They definitely can't. And at one point, they even get shown into a carriage, which actually has Luftwaffe air crew in. But it's 3 a.m. and they're all fast asleep and they don't pay any attention. Yeah, and high tension. But they make it. They get to Toulouse. And then actually Frank spends about 5 days there in a safe house with her. And then she puts the plan into action to get him into Spain, which involves going east to Perpignan,
yeah,
on the Mediterranean coast. And then from Perpignan is where Frank is going to hike over the Pyrenees.
Is that where the picture on the front cover, because you've got a picture of Halifax, you've got a picture of him in the cockpit, but there's also a picture of him on top of what, you know, that is him on the front cover, is it, presumably, with his hiking gear overlooking.
That you have spotted a very good point. That actually isn't Frank, but it's exactly why we put the photo on the front cover. Yeah, mountains,
yeah,
voyaging over the mountains. Yeah, exactly. And it's just a lovely wartime photo.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, it isn't actually him. Oh, well, but it's the best we had.
Well, of course. And the other thing is, of course, if you were to get caught carrying a camera, then you're in all sorts of trouble over there. We've only got 5 minutes, and as you can tell, Adam, I can talk to you about this until probably what day of day, Wednesday. I could keep going until Friday morning. So the because you are, you know, you've done is Exeter University you're at.
And then Cardiff.
And then Cardiff, right? So you presumably study history. Will you get a story like this? I mean, it must be, I mean, people talk about, you know, people say to me, why are you interested in history? Well, exhibit A, basically, because history is a living, breathing thing. And it's not just the grand sweep and the strategic and the tactical. It is these little stories. So how do you research this one? I'm presuming you've got family memories, but a lot of these guys came back and never talked about their experiences.
Yeah, I never got to meet Frank because he died 4 years before I was born. But I mean, I was incredibly lucky with this in terms of research because it's family history. So, you know, Frank's logbooks, his letters, his diaries, his memoir, so much memorabilia just fell into my lap. He also left a oral history at the Imperial War Museum.
Yeah.
But I guess the other big part of the research for this is in 2022, I actually went out to France,
yeah,
and spent a month retracing Frank's journey from France, from the crash site all the way down to Gibraltar, visiting all of these places that he went to. And along that journey, I managed to track down and meet descendants of these civilians who helped him, which was absolutely incredible. And often they told me lots of details and bits of color and things that had been forgotten by Frank or left out of what he wrote down and what he left behind. So that was another amazing part of the research as well.
And there's a memorial. I've seen a picture of you next to the memorial of the crash site, which is quite moving, actually. It's quite simple, but you know, it's got a tail, you know, it's got a tail plane, hasn't it? I mean, that must have been quite something. Cause again, you are sort of pushing back the curtain of history.
Yeah, it was incredible. And I mean, this is what I try to do in the book, is to talk about Frank's escape. And then, I shift into present tense and do my retracing. So, you know, you've got Frank, the crash of the people who died, and then it will go, and then there'll be a page break, and then it'll be me visiting the crash site. But this crash site is absolutely incredible, and it is very moving. And I didn't really know this before I went, but this little village in France where he crashed, they still hold memorial service every August, even now. This is 80 years later. And they get these, they get their local school kids from the area to come around, and they hold up these big placards with faces of all the airmen who died and of the civilians. But it's incredible to think that these French school kids who are like eight, walking around with these like big pictures of like, you know, 22-year-old Frank Pollard, rear gunner from Berry, and, you know, or, you know, 25-year-old navigator from Devon, and they are still remembered, and they are still incredibly grateful for their sacrifice. Even though they crashed into their village, burnt half of it down, and killed five civilians, even 80 years later, they look at that and think, wow, this is, we're so grateful for these English lads who sacrificed themselves to try and help us. So it's incredible. And it just shows that, yeah, as you were saying earlier, these World War II stories are still so powerful.
The book is called Operation Pimiento. It's by Adam Hart. Adam, if people want to find you online, where's the best place to track you down and say nice things to you?
Well, my website is either adamhart.org, or you can find me on Instagram at adamharthistory, or Facebook. It's just Adam Hart.
And you can order, and listeners, you can order the book by clicking on the link on our own virtual bookstore, and it'll be winging its way to you. What are you up to next, then, Adam? I mean, are you going to do another history? I mean, what's the next plan?
I hope so. Yeah. So I'm currently doing a research project on a Spitfire in the UK, which is pretty cool. But yeah, I've got some other ideas. I mean, there are plenty of people in this book who should have their own books, like Françoise Dessard. She should have her own book.
Absolutely. That's a mini series. And whatever happened to Colette, you see, we wonder, find out in the next installment. As I said, I can speak to you to that until next Friday, but I'm going to run out of time. I'm going to do the Cardinal sort of crashing into the news. The book is called Operation Pimiento, My Great Grandfather's Great Escape. It's a fascinating book. Adam, it's by Adam Hart, who's speaking to you today. Adam, it's been a real pleasure to speak to you, and congratulations on the book, and also congratulations on the research and for introducing such a cast of characters.
Thank you very much. It's been great to chat. Thank you.